Okay, hello. It's August 21st, 2009. My name is Deanna Tran. I'm the interviewer and the interviewee today. Her name is Bertha Langford. We are both sitting here today so that she can share her story for the Veteran History Project of the Library of Congress American Folklife Center. The location is the fourth floor of the University of Louisville Archives. And let's see, I'm recording. Let me make sure.
Okay.
Are we in here now?
It looks like it's now it's recording.
So I press
record. That stops the. This is what actually records, and this puts it in on pause.
Okay.
So it doesn't go. So it doesn't record. It means.
That's probably our introduction.
Well, no, that was just when we were just talking.
Oh, because it starts another track, right?
Yeah. So if you hit pause at some point, when you hit record again, then it starts again. So we can just leave it running.
She told me so much.
I know. I couldn't hear what you were saying, but I was like, it sounds like good stuff. So if you can, I mean, you could also kind of treat this as sort of, now you're warmed up, you've kind of gone over some of the memories. So if you have time.
I mean, okay. We'll just, you know, just ask the same questions and we'll try to get the same information, you know, that we had, you know. So.
Oh, I'm sorry.
That's okay.
Oh, no, it's my fault. I thought that was a record button. Okay.
Okay.
Okay, and that should be a DD214.
Oh. Okay.
Okay.
Sorry about that.
All right. Well, okay. I'm glad you asked.
Yeah. Before we got through it, we had nothing.
Entirely again. Okay. Hello, it's August 21st, 2009. My name is Deanna Tran. I'm the interviewer. I'm going to be interviewing Bertha Langford for the Oral History Project for the United States Library of Congress American Folklife Center. Bertha served in the Army as a PFC. She was in the reserves from 1975 to 1976 and then went on active duty from 76 to 79. Okay, we'll begin. Let's talk a little bit more about before the military. Mm-hmm. Talk about where you're from, your family life, your education.
Okay. I'm from Louisville, Kentucky. I am the middle daughter of six, four girls, two boys. I graduated from Central High School in 1974. And my sister and I decided to go into the military. I wanted to go to the Air Force. She wanted to go to the Army, so we flipped a coin and we ended up going to the United States Army. We decided we would serve in the reserves a year to see if we liked it, you know, well enough before going on active duty. So after a year, maybe not even quite a year, we decided to go into active duty. Part of the military in the reserves, we took our basic training at Fort Jackson, South Carolina. I took my AIT at Fort Benjamin Harrison at the Finance Center. I was a computer machine operator. Like I said, my sister and I, we got to go through basic training together.
Can you describe like why you wanted to go into the military, your reasons for it?
Well, actually, my sister wanted to be a nurse. I wanted to be a business major. I wanted to have my own business. And so we figured that would be a good way to help us pay for our college. And, you know, just to have the benefits of being a veteran, because being a black female and a veteran, that really held a lot back in those days, being black female and a veteran.
Right.
And we just thought it was something that we can do and thought we might, you know, enjoy doing it.
Okay.
Yeah.
Can you describe the support that you got from your family and friends?
Support was great. My mom was kind of skeptical because it was, you know, going into something that we knew nothing about. But she felt like because we were both going together that we would look out for one another. And if anything happened, you know, we'd be there for, you know, one another. But my baby sister, of course, she didn't care one way or the other. My brothers thought it was something strange for a woman to be going into the military. But we thought we were, you know, strong enough and able to handle it. So we went on and gave it a shot.
And this is during the end of the Vietnam War.
Yeah.
So kind of had a really bad reputation with the
bad reputation with veterans, bad reputation with the veterans care. But we thought
you know, going in the reserves and being able to be called up if they needed us would be some place that we can actually serve, you know, serve our country in and still benefit, you know, from doing it. But it was, you know, kind of volatile for women back in those days. I think they were open to us, but just like some men feels that they think are just for men, they thought this was something that was just for men. Sometimes men get intimidated by women that think that they could do a man's job. So I guess we had something to prove to our own self also that we were capable of doing, you know, whatever we had to do to be able to survive.
Okay. And did the Vietnam War turn you off a little bit about the military?
Not really. Okay. It didn't turn us off. When you see things like that, it makes you want to be a part of it to see how maybe you might be able to make it different. You know, if given the opportunity, you know, could we go in and really see what it's about and, like I said, take care of serving our country plus taking care of our own needs also. Because back at that time, the educational benefits were great. The housing benefit, the GI Bill was great. So it had things that would pay off, you know. Or so we thought, you know, mm-hmm. after we got out.
So you were just a teenager, high schooler during the Vietnam War. Mm-hmm. Did you ever get involved in any type of, you know, activism?
No, never did. You know, mine was mainly, you know, one-on-one when somebody would make a comment or a statement or something. I'm, you know, very opinionated in what it is I think, and I'd give my opinion of it. But I'm one to say if it's wrong, then, you know, what can we do to make it right? Or what part can I do? Because I'm a firm believer that all of us were put here to accomplish something bigger than what we are ourselves. I really do.
Okay.
I really do.
Good. Yes. Could you state whether your family had any background in the military?
No. We were the first in our family to join the military, and we've been the only ones since then to join. So we were the first females to do it.
Wow.
None of my brothers served. I don't recall my dad serving. He never said anything about it. And past my grandparents, I doubt it very seriously. So I think we were the first ones in our family to actually serve.
Was it common in the community that you're living in for people to go to the military?
For men to go, it was common. But, you know, I think back then they had to register anyway. So it was common for them, but it wasn't common for a woman. That's why we decided to go in the reserves first, to be able to see what the climate was like and if it's something that, you know, we would, you know, enjoy doing.
Okay. Let's go forward to your training for the military. You said you trained in Fort Jackson,
South Carolina. Yeah.
Describe a typical day there.
Typical day, first getting off the bus, coming into the reception station. We did not know what to expect. Absolutely not. So, you know, here's a busload of women and guys leaving from Louisville down at the federal building. I tell you, that was the strangest feeling. When they had you in that little room and you raised your hand and you took that oath, they said, now you are the property of the United States Army. I'm like, wow, this is really real. I mean, you see these kind of things on TV, but to actually be there in it and taking that oath and everything. And from that point on, like I said, you were their property. You absolutely were their property.
Wow.
And so we went to, like I said, Fort Jackson, South Carolina to take our basic training. And it was hot in South Carolina. It was Oh my God, it was hot in South Carolina. And we got off the bus, and I never will forget this drill sergeant. His name was Joe Jackson. And we hopped off, and as soon as we got off that bus, that man was up in our face. He was screaming at us, get off the bus. Throw those bags down and get back over in line. And we look at him, that man lost his mind. And me and Pam look at each other like, girl, what have we done? What have we walked ourselves into? And they specifically told everybody, there's no black, there's no white, everybody's green here. Mm-hmm. Don't worry about your mother, don't worry about your father, your sister, or your brother, because we're going to be everything to you for the next 8 weeks. And they meant that. And from that point, it's like we didn't know what we had just stepped off and walked into, you know. But as the time went on, you know, we saw that we were a part of something bigger than you know, bigger than us. A typical day at the reception station, when you first got there, they would take you, they would get your name, make out all your labels, they would give you this big duffel bag. You went to each station, you got boots, you got blouses, you got socks, you got your hats, you got your jackets, your fatigues, so you got your linen, so they outfitted you for everything that it was. No, ladies, if you had hair, it could not be on your collar, which meant you had to put it up in a ponytail.
Okay.
Or put it up on your head some kind of way, but your collar had to be clean.
Okay.
So that you could see your insignia and stuff sitting up from your jacket collar, your blouse collar, you could see it. So as long as your hair was up, that was a good thing. If mm-hmm. And if you couldn't deal with it, yes, they would cut your hair gladly.
Did you have long hair at the time?
No. As a matter of fact, I had short hair, so I was okay. My sister had long hair, so she would keep hers braided up and keep it up under her hat so that it wouldn't hang down on her collar.
Okay. Well, you said that Sergeant kind of gave you that declaration of, like, equality. Like, there's no black, there's no white, but... did you experience any, you know?
Oh yes, definitely.
Inequality.
There was inequality, and you knew that you were black, and you knew the other person was white, because within the platoon that we were in, there was black, there was white, there was Hawaiian, there was Hispanic, you know, there was large, there was small, you know, there was a marked difference with everybody. So there were some that got the message. We were all in the same boat, and the color you were made no difference. And of course, there was your typical racist people that were in there. And true enough, we fell out with some of them. You know, there were fights among the women.
Mm-hmm.
You know, and I guess that's, you know, gaining your respect or gaining your ground or gaining your foothold or whatever it was. But there was, but for the most part, they were inter-platoonal within ourselves. It was nothing that we took back to our commanding officer or anything like that. It was just amongst us ladies. And by the time, you know, our basic was over with, I think everybody had gained a new respect for each other to know, even though we do have differences, we all still have the same job in there. And that was being a soldier, plain and simple. And that's what basic training was for, to teach you how to be a better soldier, to set you up with disciplines that you didn't even know that you were capable of having, or being part of a group and working together as a group, you know, for a specific thing that you wanted to do. So once it all got down to it, we all had gained a healthy respect for one another.
Okay. And you're in a platoon with just women?
With just women, yes.
Just women.
Yes. At that time, even though we were all on the same post, there was no, you know, communal things where guys were on here and girls were, no, everybody had their own separate barracks. Now, there was times that we trained together.
Mm-hmm.
We would do PT together. We would do marches and walks together. But basically, because they trained the men in a different way than they trained the women, because the men were training for combat. Now, we got to do some of the things. We got to go out on bivouac and pitch tents, and we had the simulated, you know, bombs that they would drop when we went on night convoy.
Mm-hmm.
And that was a lot of fun. Night convoy was a lot of fun.
Really?
And, well, they put us in, and actually, that's where I actually got my license at, because when I went in, I didn't have a license. So they said, okay, everybody that can drive a stick on this side, everybody that can on this side. Okay, so I'm over here on the side that couldn't drive the stick. So I knew nothing about a clutch or anything like that. So they put us in a Jeep, and they were hollering at you the whole time. Put your foot on the clutch. You shift when you hear it going. You are a different sound. So consequently, it was like nerve-wracking. You trying to do this clutch, this big, long clutches come. No doors on the side, so you could easily fall out of this Jeep. And got that Jeep over a creek and almost turned it over in the creek with all of us in it. Yes, yes.
They made you drive over a creek?
Yes, through a creek, through water. Yeah, yeah. And but consequently, you learned, and you learned under pressure, mm-hmm. you know. And I had my license, and by the time I was done, I was licensed to drive a Jeep, a 4x4 truck, a 4x4 with a cargo, 2.5-ton truck, a 5-ton truck.
Wow.
I was qualified, you know, to drive all those things. So that was an experience.
That's impressive.
Yeah, yeah.
Wow. What about treatment of women in the military? Could you talk a little more about that?
Okay, the treatment of the women at that time, in my opinion, I don't think they appreciated women in the military. It was still more of a man thing, and that's what they do. Because when you say Army, you're not thinking about going to a 9-to-5 job. You're thinking about war and you know, things like that. But it's so beyond that. Now, if you were serving like in an office or something like that, they figured that's where women's supposed to be, either in the mess hall in that kitchen or in the office doing office work. But there were some of us that wanted to see what field work was like. That's why we chose to go on bivouac. We chose to, you know, be a part of the 25-mile march, walks, hikes, to see actually what living like that was. And when we went on bivouac, we would, you know, be out in the field with the guys. We would pitch our own tents. We ate sea rations the same way they did. We went to the bathroom in the woods the same way that they did, you know. But I don't think overall that anyone thought at that time that the military was a place for a woman. I think when they say women, they think soft, maternal, this, that, and the other. Okay, that's if we need be. But we wear all kind of hats because, see, your home could sometimes be a war zone. So that was not relevant to us, you know. So, but I don't think they really wanted women in the military at that time.
Wow.
In anything other than a capacity like that.
Wow. Did your sergeants and as well as your other comrades who were training with you, did they treat you the same? Did you feel any unequal treatment because you're a woman?
No. As a matter of fact, I think sometimes they treated us harder because we were women, because they were trying to prove a point. Mm-hmm. You know, that, okay, let's see how far we can push you and see how well you'll do if we just see if we could push you to the limit, you know. And for some of it, you know, it's very intimidating when you have someone just walk up in your face and they're talking real crazy to you. There's nothing you can do about it. So that there sets the tone for your discipline. It's like, okay, Bertha, self-control. You do not want to grab this woman around her neck and just shake a knot in her. Self-control, you know, be able to take authority no matter how they're giving it to you. So we were able to stand up, you know, to the task. Good. And I know at one time, as I'd said before, we had rained the night before, and our whole platoon, our whole company the next morning, which was 5 platoons, had marched to breakfast. And we knew nothing about their protocol or anything. And so my sister, she broke formation. She walked around a puddle instead of walking through this puddle. And the drill sergeant caught sight of that, and she stopped the whole company, which, like I said, was 5 platoons, and made her do push-ups over this puddle of water. So consequently, she had to go to breakfast full of mud and water and just stinking. And so once we got back, and, you know, I let a little time go by, I went to my drill sergeant, and I asked her, I said, drill sergeant, I said, permission to speak freely. She said, okay, private, what it is. And I just commenced to going off on her. I told her, I didn't appreciate what you did to my sister. And she asked me who she was. And I got to running off in my mouth, you know, we don't know y'all protocol. Nobody told us that was breaking formation, and you embarrassed her and made her go to breakfast like that, made her look like a fool. And she said, okay, private, that's enough. I said, no, Drill Sergeant, you told me I can speak freely, so I'm going to keep on until I get through. So I'm yada, 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 yada on until she stopped me again. And so consequently, that got me restricted to the post, that got me KP in the kitchen, that got me in a lot of trouble. But then about a week or so after that, my drill sergeant came back to me, and she told me, she said, Bertha, since you had the nerve to come and talk to me like that, I'm going to make you your platoon leader over your squad. So that way, she said, because if you can talk to me like that, then we need someone in there like that that's not intimidated by those young ladies, because you're going to run into it, that can get done what you all have to, you know, get done in your barracks. So it worked out that way. And of course, there were some young ladies that were open to me. We all had came in under the same thing, and to have me over them now, some women were fine with it because we were friends. But then you have that select few that's like, you know, you're like me. You're not getting ready to tell me nothing. So consequently, I warned them, you know, that we're all trying to do this together now. We could do it nice or we could do it nasty, and you need to be careful how you talk to me, because I do have the authority to make you do some things that you might not want to do. So consequently, there were some young ladies that got, like I said, the can of Brassos and the razor blades and the toothbrushes to get stuff up out of towel and grout and shine everything, you know, that was in there. But I think we all left in a good place. Once it was all said and done, we all left there with a healthy respect for one another as females.
That's good. Mm-hmm. Good. Do you think that you might have changed the views of males in the military, their views of you?
I think so. Okay. Because, I mean, we bonded with them. Not say woman to man, but soldier to soldier. Because, you know, we would trade our experiences and we would talk with them, and they would tell us what they went through and how some of their treatment was a lot brutal. Because I don't know why men are so brutal to one another, but the drill sergeants were really, really ugly with the men. And I don't know if that was to serve the same purpose as to, you know, get their discipline, get their respect, see where their heads were, see how strong they were or what. But they were really, you know, rougher, I think, on the men. There was one instance that we went on a 25-mile march, walk, hike with the guys. And there was one young man that couldn't keep up. And I saw the drill sergeant just haul off and kick him square in his behind with a 30-pound pack on his back and broke him down and told him to get up and run. And if he didn't get up and run, he was going to continually kick him until he got up. But they didn't do us like that. They did the men like that. And it got so bad for one soldier, and I can't think of what his name was, that he took his bed sheet and actually hung himself and threw his body out of his window. Because it really did get to be hard. I mean, like I said, it was to the point, because if you're at war, you have to be able to not crack under pressure. And maybe that was their tactics for them to see how strong they were or to get them from point A to point B. I thought it was kind of much, but, you know, I figured they had did this over and over and over again, so they knew what it took to get people in shape, you know, for what it is they had to do.
Okay. Describe your sergeants, the leadership in the Army. Was there a lot of diversity?
There was a lot of diversity. My particular drill sergeant, I had a black one, a black female, and a white female. Drill Sergeant Williams was the black female. Drill Sergeant Bark was the white female. Drill Sergeant Bark was also gay. We ran into a lot of that in there, too. But they were very diverse. Looking back on it, I think they were very fair with us because they knew what it took. You had to be a strong woman to be in the military back then because it wasn't so accepting like it is now when young ladies go in. It's not half as bad for them now that I've talked to as it was when we were in. Mm-hmm. And like I said, because they didn't feel like it was a place for us, so we really had to shape up and shine to show that, yeah, we could do this too. And like I said, we went out on bivouac with the guys. We pitched tents. We ate the same sea rations. We went through the same simulations as them. They gave us M16s, which was wonderful. You know, a full magazine with an M16. You know, that was a good feeling. That was a good feeling. And we would go out on the rifle range and the obstacle courses. They had us climbing 10-foot walls with our rifles and jumping over walls. They put us in the gas chambers, so in case if we were to be in any war situation, we would know what that gas would feel like. So they would put us in the gas chamber and we'd have our masks and everything on, and they'd make us jog up and down in place until we broke a sweat because they wanted you to see what the gas felt like on your skin.
What did it feel like?
Oh, it burned. It burned. And they told us, now when y'all take that mask off, we want you to say your name, rank, and social security number and walk out the door. There was a tree right outside that door. So they told us, do not run. Walk out the door. Of course, some folks ran out that door because the gas got to burning their skins and getting down their throat. And a few of them hit that tree outside that door. You know, but like I said, you jog up and down, you know, United States Army, you know, PFC, Bertha Scott 4178-7256 with the mask off. Room full of gas, sweating, and it's just burning your skin.
How many times did they do that to you all?
Well, if you got through it the first time, you were good. Okay. But if you ran out or you hit that tree, you had to go back and do it again. Oh, you had to go back and do it again.
That's terrifying. So, yeah. How long did you have to sit in the chamber for?
Until you jogged in place, about 3 minutes, until you jogged in place and you broke out into a sweat. Because like I said, they wanted you to actually feel what that gas felt like on your skin had you, you know, encountered it. Mm-hmm. And so we got through that. They gave us M16 rifles. We were in foxholes. We were in the prone position on our backs, crawling under barbed wire with the rifles. We were on our stomachs, crawling on our elbows in the mud with the rifles. And what I liked about it, you know, our drill sergeants were so mean to us. We got to look at the targets. You know, every target I shot was my drill sergeant. I killed her a million times on the rifle range. And then one night we were out on night convoy. We were in 2.5-ton trucks, 5-ton trucks. No lights, just little bitty lights so that the enemy would not be able to see you. It's little red lights. And they would throw these simulated bombs that make the flashes to mess up your night vision. We're riding along this road. You look over the side, there is nothing but drop-off at night. There is nothing but drop-off. So we had to gain our composure, and I'm in this big 5-ton truck.
Are you driving?
I'm driving. Oh, trying to keep this truck on this road and not on the edge of that thing. It was the scariest thing because we literally could have died out there like that.
That was like your first time driving
yes,
on the road like that.
Yes, that was my first time even, like I said, I got my license there. So that's my first time even encountering driving a truck like that, you know. And they would throw these and we'd have to, you know, throw it in park. And the ones would jump out the back with their rifles and kind of fall out and kind of, you know, get out because enemy was coming at us. And so they would, at night, you would fill your magazine with red tracers so that you'd be able to see them at night.
Yeah.
And so we were shooting red tracers out of the M16s wow. all over the place thinking we were at the enemy. And they were simulating throwing the bombs and things, you know, dropping them on us. And it was real interesting. Scary at the time, but yeah. now that I look back on it, it was a lot of fun.
Wow.
It was a lot
that
of fun.
That does sound a lot.
Yeah, it was a lot of fun. Wow. Yeah.
Let's see. Oh, yeah. You mentioned that your drill sergeant was homosexual.
Yes.
Could you kind of give us your experience with homosexuals?
Yes. There were gay females there. What we found out about them, they were not openly gay. They stayed within their own cliques, so to speak. They would never just approach you to try to get with you. You know, if they knew that you were, they would, you know, somehow have a conversation with you to invite you to, you know, have your meals and stuff with them. Or at the end of the day, when they were doing laundry or spit shining boots, they'd all sit around and talk together. It was a big communal shower. So those of us that weren't gay, we was like, okay, y'all just need to kind of stay on over and do what it is y'all do. We're going to stay on over here and do what it is we don't do, okay? So they were very respectful. It wasn't an open thing. They were very respectful with, you know, their sexuality, and that's what they wanted to do. So you never had to worry about them touching you or anything, you know, like that. Outside of that, they were, you know, just like we were. My sister, there was a young lady named... we called her St. Pete. She was from St. Petersburg, Florida. Her name was Debbie. And she took a liking to my sister. And I had to tell her, you know, Debbie, we don't roll like that. My sister's will does not roll like that. If I catch you bothering her, then you're going to have problems, you know, out of me. But consequently, Debbie became a real good friend to Pam because Pam was kind of quiet. And so she kind of, you know, looked out for her and took up for her. Pam was left-handed, and so she couldn't zero her weapon in. It was real hard for left-handed people to zero their M16s in. So, you know, she helped her on the rifle range, you know, with things like that. And so, like I said, she became a really good friend. So it wasn't a problem for us, you know, because everybody knew where they stood, and nobody bothered, you know, anybody else. So it was okay. It was okay. We respected them, you know, just because they were women and they were in there doing the same function that we were doing.
Okay. No, I don't remember. Did we talk about racism on this tape yet? Or
not yet. No, yeah. Not on this one.
Okay, so let's talk about racism.
Yes, there was, yeah, just like today, it was racism then. Mm-hmm. You found whites that were whiter than white and blacks that weren't black enough. And, you know, you had the words and the name calling and everything. And it was just like, I guess it is now, you just had to gain your respect for whatever situation you was in with whomever you was in it with. Mm-hmm. And we had instances, oh yeah, it was nothing to be called the N-word, you know. And you look at folks, it's like, you can't fight everybody. You know, some things you just had to ignore. But then there was one young lady that we actually had to just kind of get within there because she would just throw that word around like she was popping gum. Uh-oh. And it's like, girlfriend, you can't use that word. You know, when I hear that's what they call y'all, first of all, we're not a y'all. You know, we're a person just like you're a person. Just because our skin color is different doesn't mean you any better than I am, or I mean less than you are. Mm-hmm. You know, so we had a couple of instances where we literally had to put our hands on each other to get the point across. But we did it amongst ourselves. It wasn't something that got outside of our platoon, that got back to our commander, that got to our company commander, that got to our brigade commander. It wasn't anything that serious. We took care of it in-house. And I think after it was all said and done, we all had a healthy, you know, respect for one another. But yeah, a lot of times that's just overall, like I said, I don't care if it's gay, color, political views, whatever it is. It was then such as it is now. It's a lot more open now than it was then. Now they have that don't ask, don't tell or something like that. Well, back then it's like you just need to keep your mouth closed, period. Ain't no ask, don't tell. You just need to be quiet. Because then it would have gotten you put out of the military.
Right.
It would have gotten you put out.
And it still does, right?
I think, but with the don't ask, don't tell, it's like they're not seeking it if they see it. Mm-hmm. You know what I'm saying? They might see you and think that you are, but now it's like, don't ask, I'm not telling. So unless it's just something out and out blatant where there's a male and female, a commander that's hitting on an enlisted person or something like that, you know, that they really do have to contain, because that was very prevalent also. They felt like because they were in a leadership position over you, mm-hmm. that some of the things that they would tell you, you had to abide by because they were who they were and you were who you were. But even with those things, you had to stand up on your feet. It's like, you know what? You're a man in the military, and you are a non-commissioned officer over an enlisted person. I'm not stuck and stupid, and if you keep coming at me like you coming at me, then I will go tell somebody, but they can make it very hard on you, so you had to be really careful about the channels that you went through, you know, to do something like that. And then we were always of the mind, we were never alone. When you went somewhere, you took another lady with you. You never by yourself, never. Because, like I said, there were men drill sergeants over us females, mm-hmm. you know, which means they could have come in, you know, anytime they wanted into the barracks and this, that, and the other under the guise of being your drill sergeant, but still they're male with an agenda. Right. So you just had to be very careful. So we all just never went anywhere unless somebody else was with us.
Okay.
Yeah.
And did the women support each other? You know, did they form bonds because they were women?
Yes, we did. Okay. We did. We had to. And like I said, outside of our differences, and maybe after the first couple of weeks, maybe 2 or 3 weeks there, we went through all the roughness of everybody filling everybody out and right. seeing where everybody was. And we knew we had this thing to do, and we had to stick together to do it, no matter what color our skin was, no matter what your, you know, your sexuality was. We had to stick together to get this done, because if you didn't, they'd recycle you to the next class and you have to go through it all over again.
Oh, wow.
Yes.
I imagine you made a lot of friends.
Yes.
Do you remember any of them? You want to talk about them?
Yeah. I made Debbie Greer is another friend of ours. She was from
different Debbie?
It's a different okay. Debbie. Mm-hmm. Okay. Debbie Greer, she was from Milwaukee, Wisconsin. Smoothest chick, just tall, model-esque. Just crazy. And we met her, Pam and I met her. As a matter of fact, we're still friends with her. I'm still friends with her today because my sister has since passed. But I'm still friends with Debbie. Another girl, her name was, we called her Sondheim.
Okay.
Her name was Siobhan. I can't think what Siobhan's last name was. Even some of the guys, even after I graduated from basic and did my AIT, I had occasion to go back and see Drill Sergeant Joe Jackson to let him know that I did make it and I'm fine and everything is going on, because I had some friends that were there in South Carolina. Mm-hmm. He said, well, you know, we did what we did to you all just to get y'all through. Yeah, whatever. You can tell us that now. We wasn't believing that then, okay? So,
was it different meeting him outside of
the outside world? It was different. I mean, there was an adult respect, not yeah. necessarily male, female, but an adult respect that I got through what you put me through, mm-hmm. and I'm still standing, and I'm here to talk about it. And so, you know, respect from that point that you took everything that we put out, and you're still standing to talk about it. It's like, yeah, you're not as bad as you thought you were. See, you had authority, and I didn't have none, but I was always one to buck the system. I was always, you know, private drop and give me 20. You know, it's like, dang, go into my turn around, y'all making me do push-ups, threads. You know, they see you with a thread on you. You know, you need to drop and give me 20. For
really?
What? Yes.
For thread?
For thread. Better yeah. not have a thread hanging on that uniform nowhere, and you better not see a fingerprint on that brass either. No, ma'am.
Wow.
No, ma'am. It was very strict. You could be out at 6 o'clock in the morning and hear reveille. You better get out of that car and salute that flag wherever you're at. You get out of the car right there.
Do you find yourself doing that now?
Girl, I catch... Look, I still fold my socks so they smile. This is 30 years later.
Wow.
I still fold my socks so they smile. I still hang all my hangers the same way in the closet. None of them are backwards. My toothbrushing thing, they're still stationary. And I'm very... It made me very organized. And I'm still that way today.
We're going to talk more about that in a different part of our interview. But let's move on to, I guess you moved on to the reserves right after training, or?
Yes, I came back home to my home unit, and I was a computer machine operator. That's the training that I took up at the Finance Center at Fort Benjamin Harrison.
Okay.
And that's a story up there, too. One night we were out, and it was maybe about 2 o'clock in the morning, and we had been to the club and everything. And so we were, you know, walking back home to the bags. Girl, MPs, all you saw was blue lights everywhere you look. And MPs were gathering us up off of the streets. We were in heels. We were in stockings. We were in dresses. The pipes had burst over at the finance center. And the finance center is where you keep all of the military payroll at.
Oh, no.
So water could not touch those records.
Right.
So they was picking up everybody they saw on the street. They didn't care what you was in, where you was coming from. They gave us buckets and mops and squeegees and to get that water off that floor so that it wouldn't, you know, they had the guys putting the records up and then the women trying to push the water out where the pipes had burst. And then consequently, about 3 days later, I ended up with pneumonia there. We were in knee deep water. And we were just trying to save the records there at the finance center. That was very funny. So we came back home after our reserve training, and we served in our unit over in Jeffersonville, Indiana. We worked in the capacity in which we trained for. Was
Can you say the year?
1976.
Okay.
1976. And so we worked within our unit, doing what we were trained with the computers and everything, and spooling all of Jeffersonville's reserve units, all of their grades, all of their notes, all of the pertinent information on the troops, and, you know, inventory in our motor pool and stuff like that. Actually, literally putting these things, we had nothing like the technology today. We had the old time tape drives and card readers and card sorters and card punches. This big rooms with big spools of computer data, and these rooms were cold and very informal. Nothing like today, the little bitty microchips and
right.
stuff that they have. And so we worked within our unit.
How'd you receive training to do that kind of work?
That's what my AIT was, computer okay. machine operator. I took that up at Fort Benjamin Harrison, Indiana.
Okay.
That's
okay,
where I took my training. And then I came back home and worked in my reserve unit in Indiana doing what I was trained for in AIT.
Okay. Do you want to talk a little bit about the schooling? I know you showed me your grades.
Yeah. Schooling, it was interesting. It was very interesting. Like I said, it was a big, cold computer room. We had, I guess at that time, you know, top-notch computer material to be able to spool the grades and the class grades. And I was like third in my class. I did very well.
Wow.
And so it was just like you do now when you go to class now. You go, you work in the field that you're in. Because what a lot of people didn't realize, when you think about Army or any type of military, you're thinking serving in a war or something.
Yes.
But other than that, it's like a 9-to-5, like any other 9-to-5. You're just in military uniform on a military post doing military business. It's just like a regular 9-to-5.
Okay.
There's nothing any different about it than what we would do out here on a job right now, except it was military oriented.
What attracted you to becoming a machine or computer machine operator?
Well, I knew something just told me in the future computers were going to be a big thing.
Right.
You know, because they had to find a way. Technology has to grow in order for, you know, for us to grow. We can only hold so much information in our head. So there had to be a way to compile information, list information, to be able to pull up information. So something just told me that computers were going to be something big in the future. And I wanted to get a jump start on what was going on. Consequently, what I learned then has nothing to do with what
goes
on
instincts.
Now.
Good
you
instincts.
Know, it has nothing to do with it. I look at the stuff now, and it's like I look at our generation of children coming up. It's like they're born with that computer gene. I mean,
mm-hmm.
they come out the womb, you know, wanting a Wii or something that they can do. You know, it's just,
iPod.
It's yeah, iPods is just something that just comes so normal to you all. And I just thought I was getting to jump on everything, you know, that was going on. So
yeah. Well, that's good.
Yeah.
Let's see. Yeah, talk a little bit more about your experience in the reserve.
And, well, we worked, like I said, over in the unit in Jeffersonville. And, of course, there were those men. Okay, here come these women. And what are y'all going to do, you know, other than work in the office? It's like, whatever. You know, it's like, if you can do it, we can do it. We don't try to be men, but we just want to let y'all know that we can be thought about on the same level playing ground as you all. We don't have to be as physical as you. We don't have to be built like you. But there are things that you all need that we can do that you all can't do because we're female, you know. I said, we're just here to support you all, not to try to outdo you all or show you all up. We're just here in support of what it is you do. So y'all just need to accept us from where it is we are. So once you got past that hard place, but of course there are some that just were not forthcoming. You are female. You got them green fatigues and boots on. Let's see what you can do. They was always challenging us as women in the military, like we had something to prove and we were taking something away from them. You know, they're always going to be those gung-ho men, like woman here, man here. There's always going to be those. And then there's always going to be those that are open to where, you know, well, come on, can I help you? And like I said, we're in support of them. We're not in competition with them. We're in support of them. And, you know, men's egos tend to get in the way. I don't care if it's military, non-military. They think women have their place. But here in 2009, we've shown them we can serve in the military. We can have children. We can do it all. Mm-hmm. You know, it's just something we're built to do.
Right.
You know, we can do it.
What's really unfortunate is that it's still happening.
It's still happening. Yeah, still happening. You know, that's a man's job. Okay, you're climbing that pole, splicing those wires. Okay, why can't I climb that pole and splice those wires? Because I'm a woman? Why?
Right.
That makes no sense. Mm-hmm. The only difference between me and you is I could have children and you can't. But, you know, and I might not be made body-wise like you, but I don't have to be to get the job done, you know.
Right, right.
So, yeah, there are still some stereotypical men that think we have our place. That's with children and in the kitchen. Wrong again. We have left that on the launch pad over there. We're not even addressing that anymore with them, you know, because we've showed up. And what a lot of people, I think, probably don't realize about women in the military, we have been there from the beginning. We've been there as nurses. We've been there as field support people. We've been there, but we've not been recognized because the thing about war and military is what's going on at the most brutal level. But you can't get to the brutal level if you're not laid the foundation. And see, the women have been the foundation upon what all that's done. Because when you call in and you want to know where something is located or something like that, that's a woman at that support thing right there. So see, we're in support of what it is you're doing, not to be in competition. There's even some women that are pilots. I mean, gunner pilots,
right.
And you know, that are paratroopers. You know, I don't know if they'll let any of us be Navy SEALs yet or not, but we can do this, you know, just like them. So we're not in competition with them. I don't know when they'll get to that point, but women are usually in the foundation of what's laid in this country, period. Because number one, there's a woman raising that man from childhood to get you to where you're at, number one.
Right.
So see, there's always a woman going to be somewhere involved. So I think it's really time for them to give us our due diligence to know that we're not in competition. We're here to be in help to you and support to you and what it is you have to do. But we can do it too. We can do it too.
Yeah,
and in some cases, we can do it better.
Yeah. Do you have any heroes in the military?
No, I can't say that I do, but I recently found out that Queen Elizabeth II was in the military. She was in the Army, and she was a mechanic, and I didn't know that.
Oh, okay.
And I didn't know that. So, see, that's why something like this is very important for them to see that there have been women serving all along in key places, you know, and it's not really talked about, and it doesn't make any difference what color you are, just the fact that we just want to be included. We don't want to, you know, take your glory or anything, but we want to know that we made sacrifices, you know, and we made accomplishments, and we gave things that were, you know, that you never even thought about. A woman's brain thinks totally different than a man, you know, so whereas you're over here thinking this, we're over here thinking this, which is going to help you over here. So, you know, like I said, we all have something to offer.
Right.
But I can't think of any female heroes. I really take my hat off to the nurses that they had during the war, the way that they were able to go in under pressure and look at all of the wounds and the missing limbs and the everything when they just wanted to feel like they needed a woman's hand to hold when they were going through their suffering. You know, I take my hat off to them to even to be able to serve in that capacity to see all that they saw and still serve and still want to serve, you know.
Right, right.
Yeah.
Wow. Let's talk about your active duty, going from reserve to active duty.
Yes. After we stayed in the reserves, then it's like, well, Pam, you know, it might not be that bad. Let's just go on and try active duty.
So you're still with your sister.
So I'm still with my sister. Okay. And so she said, okay, well, let's do it. So then we had to go to, we had to take part of our basic training over again.
Really? Why?
Oh, my God. Because we had been away from that part of it for almost a year, you know, after we had it. So we had to go and get a refresher course. That time they sent us to Fort McClellan, Alabama for that. And so we went through the PT test and we went, had to, you know, redo on the rifle range again with all of that. And, you know, I think it takes some, I think, I want to say it was some paper tests and things that we had to take. But the PT tests, they were really big on you staying physically fit. Mm-hmm. Because I think it was a more physical Army then than it is now. Mm-hmm. Because there's a lot of things that they have now that they didn't have 30 years ago that helped them implement what it is they do now that was manual labor back then. So they wanted you to stay fit. To do that, so we had to take that back over again. And from there, she went to Fort Dix, New Jersey, after she left Fort McClellan, Alabama. And for some reason, they sent me to Fort Leonard Wood, Missouri. My God, if there has never been a worse place on the planet, Fort Lost in the Woods. Oh, my God. There's nothing there. It's in the middle of Missouri, and there's nothing there.
Oh, wow.
And from that point, they said, well, we can't get you into the MOS that you initially trained in. So we'll put you here within, it was like the motor pool, it was like three things, like motor pool, mess hall, and where they did your clothes, issued you all your clothes and stuff. Because it was not for training, because I had already had my training. Mm-hmm. It was just to get me acclimated back again into the military way of life. And so that's where I was in, like, Delta 5-4 there. I learned so much. I tell you, God, he puts you places that you need to be when you need to be, because I was able to pull maintenance. Honey, before I couldn't change oil, I couldn't change a tire. When I left, I could pull maintenance on a 5-ton truck, on a 2-ton truck, change the oil, change the wheels, you know, the whole 9 yards. I was able to do that all. And then after they did find a place for me in the operations department, then I was in the operations department within, you know, Fort Leonard Wood's post, given when they would send paperwork in from the trainees and troops and stuff, you know, you put it all where it had to be. You'd send memos to the commander and here and there. And so it was really interesting. It was really interesting. So I got to work in my MOS after that little bit of training with those trucks and things. And they even gave me orders, and I'm going to try to find a copy of those, where I was to go to West Point, and I was going to be a driver for one of the generals there.
Oh, wow.
Yeah. And so, consequently, after about maybe a couple of months or so, they said that the general's wife did not really feel good about having a female driver. Oh. So they sent me from there to Fort Bragg, North Carolina.
Okay.
Because they did not want me there in West Point. West Point at the time was, you talk about racist, redneck, stodgy, cigar-smoking men. Girl, that was the
that was the
capital.
Oh, God.
Oh, they were awful. They were awful.
But that's where they train their officers.
Exactly. Oh. Exactly. But it's almost like having an all-men's club and there's no women invited. You know, they're just... You know, they're the kind that once the uniform is off, they got the bass Ouijans and the tweed and that. I mean, just very stodgy people.
Mm-hmm.
It was not a place. When you say West Point, you think of the highest honor.
Right.
You know, you think of the highest honor and our commanders and our generals and stuff. But at the end of the day, they're still people.
Mm-hmm.
That's just a title that they hold. They're still people. They're still prejudiced people. Mm-hmm. You know, they're still opinionated people. You know, there are still people that are stuck in that era that they were in. And, you know, I mean, even the women officers were not treated with the highest respect there at West Point. They were not. You know, you a male and you start in as a second lieutenant if you've had college. But here's a lady over here that's had more college than you, so she might come in as a first lieutenant. Okay, why are you mad at her?
Right.
That's my thing. You know, she's on the same level playing ground as you are. She got an education, if not better than the one that you got. So what? You mad because she's female and she has the audacity to come up here and show her face on a campus full of men? Mm-hmm. So even then, the female officers were not treated with the highest respect, even there.
So did you hear of these stories from other people? Or
from other people.
People who were there?
Yeah, from other people. And then one young lady that was actually there, she and her husband both had went in together, and they both went in as second lieutenants. And she would tell me, she said, Bertha, you know, I might wear this uniform, but to them, I'm no different than you are. Wow. You know, you had to really fight for respect back then for that. Wow. Yeah.
Oh, goodness. So you were on active duty for 3 years?
Yeah, about 2.5, because with our year in the reserve, I think we only signed up for like a 3-year term. Now, my sister signed up for a little bit more time, and she went to Germany. See, I, at the time, had a son, and I did not want to go across that water because Germany was not the place for a female to be. They did not like females in the military. Girl, you allowed to go over to Germany and get hurt back then, being a female. They liked the men. Oh, yeah, they liked the men. And over there, I want to say at the time, I don't know if prostitution was legal over there yet or what, but girl, they had these walls and all this stuff going on over there. It was not a good place. Yes. And they let you know that they did not like you, because my sister would write back home and tell us things about how they was treated. She was over in Gießen, Germany. Mm-hmm. And she took another 18 months. I'm like, no, I'm not doing another 18 months. I'm done. I've done my time. I've done what I'm supposed to do. I'm ready to get out and go on with my life. But you know what? Now thinking back on it, mm-hmm. and as fast as I've seen time go by, right. there have been times that I wish I would have just stayed and put my 20 years in. But at the time, OD Green was just not appealing to me. It just wasn't. I got tired of being talked to crazy. I got tired of being treated sideways. And me knowing myself and the temperament that I had, sooner or later, if I kept doing that, then something probably would happen that would have stalled my career, you know. Mm-hmm. I had problems with men in there. Like I said, and these were commissioned officers and non-commissioned officers. You know, and I had a problem with them. And it's like, I don't want to get hemmed up in all of this. I don't want to be somebody's tragedy in the military. There were girls that had gotten pregnant in there by non-commissioned officers. And it's just like anything else. It's your word against theirs. If you didn't have proof, it's like, well, young lady, well, what was you doing here in conjunction with this? It was almost like the man was always right. And I knew that I just did not want to be a part of that. Okay. I just didn't want to be a part of it.
Okay. So, do you want to kind of describe your, I guess, your exit from the military? Like,
well, exit was very, I mean, it was very calm. It was very serene, you know. Like I said, they took us back. We looked over everything that we had been through, all the accomplishments that we made. Everybody at the end of the day shown their personage, that outside of their little tucked up drill sergeant hats on the side and their little shiny brass and their little insignia, at the end of the day, they were people too, and they were just doing a job. Mm-hmm. You know, they did not have the same mentality talking to us after the fact that they had while we were going through it. They were very people, like normal people. And a lot of them said, you know, we put you all through that because when you're put into a combat situation, we have to know exactly what you'll do under pressure. Mm-hmm. So sometimes they had to put the pressure on like that to see what we were made of, if we were going in the right direction. And some that thought they were, you could steer them someplace else so as not to send them into harm's way. So at the end of the day, my exit was very, like I said, was very, very unassuming. I got my awards, I got my accolades, I got my thank yous and nice little letters to put in my jacket and everything. And it served me well. It served me well.
Do you want to talk about some of those awards or accolades or accomplishments?
Well, at my unit in, I got my accolades when I was in basic training, of course, being my platoon leader and everything, you know, I got awards for that. And I'm always one to take charge. I'm never one just to sit back and you just need to give me my instruction, tell me what to do. I'm going to give you 110%. And I think I got a letter in my jacket from Delta where I worked within their operations unit, and they gave me a nice letter about my accomplishments there and how much I helped and changed, you know, some of the policy that they had, you know, there with that.
What kind of policies?
Like in our standard operating procedures, which are called SOPs, just with dealing with people, with some of the way that the office was set up and they received information and information wasn't gotten out in a timely fashion. Mm-hmm. And we kind of implemented a few different techniques that kind of streamlined the process for that particular unit. Because mm-hmm. the Army, and I guess any branch of the military, it's a lot of paperwork. It is so much paperwork, and that's why they have SOPs, which are standard operating procedures, for mm-hmm. each place that you go, because each place operates totally different from the other place. I mean, you know, you have your basic overall rules, but just like, I guess, within this Library of Congress, you all have certain protocols that you all have, certain things that have to be done certain ways. And there were some things that I think it was Delta 5-4, I think it was, that we changed some of the procedures about how they do some of their inter-office, like I said, getting paperwork in, getting it put in particular places, and then getting it out to where it needs to in a timely fashion, and crossing your T's and dotting your I's. Because when you have a lot of people just working, doing a 9-to-5, they'll come in, girl, they'll throw papers, you'll go over and see a stack of papers. It's like, oh my God, you all have this lady's orders in here and she's supposed to ship out in 2 weeks, right? And y'all haven't even gotten these things to her. So we kind of streamlined the process, because I'm not a person for confusion. I like to have things decent and in order, which comes from my military training. And so there's just a certain flow, right, you know, that has to be of things. And, you know, took care of that.
Okay.
And even over in Jeffersonville, we implemented some new things for over the way that they ran their operations, you know, over there. So
okay.
It was just kind of a plus, you know, being a part of it. So,
okay. Do you want to read your discharge papers, or I don't know? Do you
okay,
want to
let's
that?
See. Okay. It says, upon your, this is a letter of appreciation from Fort Leonard Wood, Missouri, D Company, 5th Battalion, 4th AIT Brigade. It's an engineering brigade. It says, upon your departure from this company, I want to take the time and this opportunity to thank you for the outstanding job that you have accomplished. Your personal efforts, sense of responsibility, loyalty to your superiors, and your willingness to excel in any task assigned to you has proven to be exceptional. I hope that you will continue to demonstrate and present yourself in the outstanding manner you exemplified while working with the operations section of Delta 5-4. I thank you for a job well done and wish you continued success in all your endeavors, and may God bless you. And it was signed by our Sergeant First Class Edwin F. Russell Jr. And that was in June of 1976.
So how does that make you feel?
That makes me feel good. I mean, because, you know, you do things and you do things because you know you're supposed to. But at the end of the day, when you know that somebody really appreciates it enough to give you something to put in your jacket, it means a lot. It means a lot.
You mentioned that you had a son.
Yes, I have a son.
In the military.
Yes.
Here
was the history with that. I was 21 at the time, and my older sister was 22. And I had a son. He was about 2 at the time. And for some reason that weekend, I had spent the weekend with my sister. Had never spent the weekend with her before. So we were up that morning talking. And I said, well, Pat, I'm going to go in here and I'm going to lay down and I'll be back in a few minutes. So something told me to get up, and I got up about 20 minutes later and I walked back into the living room, and there was my sister laying on the floor, dead at 22. She had a massive heart attack at 22. Yes, I was 21, messed me totally up. And for some reason, I had to be the one. There's always one in the family, and I probably should negate even saying this, but there's always one in the family when something happens, it seems like everybody wants to go to. So I had to go and pick my mom up and bring her back over there, because there was a brother that lived in the same complex that my sister lived in. And I had him come over so I could go and get my mom. And I said, you know, Mama, you need to come with me. You know, something has happened. And like I said, she just dropped dead. I kicked her. I said, girl, get up out of the floor and get in the bed. What are you doing in the middle of the floor? She was already dead. Because when I looked at her, her lips had started turning. Her fingers were started turning blue on the tip ends of her fingers. And it unnerved me so bad That's when I went to court. I gave my mother custody of my son. And that's when me and my sister decided that we'd go into the military. I just had to get away from here. I just had to get away from here.
Okay.
Yeah.
Wow. So yeah. She was older than you,
right? Yeah, a year older. Mm-hmm.
Wow. And yeah. Heart attack at 22?
At 22.
And she was in the military.
No, this is the other one. This is my oldest sister. This is my oldest. Four of us girls. Pat, she died at 22. I was 21. Pam, the one that went in the military with me, when she was 29, she had a heart attack. She died also. Just quick. No hospital, no suffer, no nothing. Gone.
Does it run in your family?
We thought maybe there was something, but, you know, since then, my daughter, even my granddaughter and I, we all stay checked every 6 months. You know,
your grandmother?
I'm a grandmother. Yeah.
Don't look like one.
I have a 36-year-old son. Yeah, and a 26-year-old daughter. Yeah.
Really young.
Yeah.
You look good.
Yeah. Thank you. And so we, you know, periodically we get checked to make sure, but we found out that my oldest son, but Pat, had what they called cardiomyopathy, which is a diseased heart muscle. So somewhere along the line in her life, she would have needed a heart transplant. We didn't know it. Pam, one day she had a real bad nosebleed, and I mean, blood was just pouring out of her nose from what the lady was telling us. And a blood clot dislodged from somewhere after that nosebleed, a couple of days after that nosebleed, and got in the main ventricle of her heart. Stopped her heart. Ambulance got there. They got her heart started back again in the ambulance. But by the time they got to the hospital, her heart stopped again. That was it.
She had a nosebleed?
No, I mean blood pouring out of your nose. Okay. Don't know where it came from. Don't know where it came from.
So if anything, if blood is pouring from any part of your body, you should probably go see a doctor.
Yes, you should go. Because blood does not pour from your body like that. Even a slight nosebleed, if you cut yourself or something like that, it's very minute. Blood was pouring from her nose. So they don't know if one of her ventricles just broke loose or anything. I don't even remember what her cause of death was. But we do remember that nosebleed, and it was something to do with a blood clot.
Oh.
Mm-hmm.
Just anywhere on the body, if you had a cut on anywhere in your body and just blood started pouring out, should you see a doctor?
Well, if you could put pressure on that to stop the bleeding, but from what I understand, anytime it comes like from above the head, something is wrong in there that's causing that much blood to come out.
Really?
Yeah.
I should go see a doctor.
Mm-hmm.
That happened to me.
Just really?
Yeah.
You should have them go and check that. You really should. Like I said, anytime you cut yourself, that's something you could apply pressure to and actually stop the bleeding.
Right.
But anytime any what they call orifice pours blood, you should go and see about it.
Okay.
Yeah.
Okay. Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
That's really scary.
Yeah. Okay. It is. It really is. You never know what's going to happen.
Oh gosh.
So if you got a nosebleed that you can't stop with ice or something like that, then you go in and you let them check. It could be a blood vessel because, you know, my dad died of an aneurysm. You know, it could be a blood vessel that's popped somewhere, you know, too much pressure in a blood vessel. It's just like when you pull an air hose off an air thing and you just see it going like that. That's how your blood vessels do once they've been under pressure and they pop. And that's like an aneurysm in your head, which is what happened to my dad. It's like a blood vessel burst, you know.
Mm-hmm. So I have like, I'm like right here, it's not even a cut, but and it's not a pimple or anything, it just started bleeding.
Really?
Profusely.
Oh yeah, you need to go get that checked, just to let them see what that is. Yeah. Right. I mean, that's not normal.
I didn't think it was normal
It's
either.
Not normal. But like I said, if it doesn't cause us discomfort or anything, just out of the normal, we say, okay, well, you stopped, you know, that's fine. But, and I would surely say, if it's happened once and it hasn't happened again, it just might be a fluke or something. But if it's something that happens, you got to go get that checked.
Yeah.
You really should. No.
Okay. Do you want to share any other memories from the military before we go on to post-military?
No, I think that's really the... I mean, we could probably sit here all day and talk about little stories here and there, you know, of things that happened. But, you know, overall, I really enjoyed the experience. And like I said, it really shaped me for who I am today. And a lot of people even today would tell me, they say, Bertha, you know, you're really kind of brisk. You know, when you talk to people, and I have to tell people, you know, when I talk to you, just listen to what it is I'm saying. Don't mistake my tone of voice because that's just how I talk. I don't talk like this to this person or that person. When you are sure about what it is you're talking about and what it is you're saying, I say it in a form that I guess people take. It's not sweet with sugar and stuff on it. I'm not that person. I'm a nice person, yes, but I'm not that person. When I talk, I'm concise about what I talk about. I'm a no-nonsense kind of person. When it's time to have fun, it's time to have fun. When it's time to be serious, it's time to be serious. I'm a driven individual. I have my own business that, it helps me in my business to be able to either work within a group or work by myself. When I'm given a set of things to do, I multitask, I get them done. I'm willing to put whatever time it is in to do whatever it is that I got to do to make sure that the outcome is what I expect first, and then what either my customer or whoever I'm dealing with, expects also. So it's really shaped me to be the person that I am. It really has.
So yeah, it's shaped you positively.
Yeah, it did. I have no negative residual, even with a lot of the, racism and the name calling and all that kind of stuff. At the end of the day, that's over there. I don't even have to deal with it. It's all a choice. Right. Once you are confronted with something, you handle it. I'm done with it. I'm done. There's no need to keep rehashing and re-going over something, because my motto is, it is what it is. Nothing I can do about that beyond that. Nothing I could do.
So right after the military, did you open your business?
No, as a matter of fact, when I got out of the military, I've always sewn. I've sewn since I was a kid. I started sewing on my hand when I was in elementary school. There was four of us girls, like I said, and my aunt worked at a hotel, and she would have all this men's suiting fabric, and she would bring it in. And at that time, we were poor, but we didn't know it. And what I would wear to school, I'd wash out that night for Pam to wear. What Pat wore to school, she washed out for me to wear. So it was like that. I got tired of that real quick. And so I would take these pieces of fabric, and I would just cut squares, and I'd get a needle and thread, honey. I'd make me skirts. I'd gather them up, put a waistband on them, and hem them up, and didn't have buttonholes or anything like that. Put my safety pin in. I thought I was cute. Yes, I did. And when I got into about the ninth grade, my mom saw that I was serious, and bought me my first sewing machine. So I've been sewing since I was a kid, but when I first got out, I did factory work. I worked at Philip Morris. I worked at Laura Lord. I worked at a place making draperies. I worked at a place making tote bags. I designed that ride gear bag for our Kentucky State Troopers at the bag place that I worked at. And I worked at the Indiana Army Ammunition Plant making bags for bombs. And everywhere I went, I took a little bit of that learning everywhere I went. And I guess maybe about 15 years ago, I said, I'm going to take all this knowledge and I'm going to do it for myself. And so I stopped working for everybody else and I started working for myself. So I do custom dressmaking and embroidery. I have my own business and I do very well at it. Wow. I do very well at it.
Do you feel that when you tell people that you were in the military that they, kind of respect you more?
I do. I really do. Yeah. They say, you were in the Army? It's like, yes, I was in the Army, And they say, wow, so that's what it is about you. That's where that comes from. Yeah. Mm-hmm. Yeah.
What about family life after the military?
Family life after the military, where I eventually got married. Okay. And like I said, I had my son then and I have a daughter now. And I've been married for 23 years.
Wow.
And like I said, I'm a grandmother. And life's been good. I'm not going to say it hasn't been hard, but it's been good. It's been fair. God is good. I've met so many wonderful people. I guess my thing is to help people. I'm always wanting to be that person to advocate that you can be the best that you can be. And I try to give the benefit of my knowledge to our young girls. I give back. I work through my church. I go to Canaan Christian Church. And I work through some organizations with giving back to young girls, with teaching them how to sew, to dress, not to be out here and show all your body parts, and just give them the better part of my knowledge to help them be, the best young ladies that they can be. Because I realize our mothers are a lot younger now, and what they weren't taught, they're not able to teach. So we see our young girls out here all willy-nilly. So I asked my pastor, why don't you let me teach a sewing class over here? And that will help the single mothers that have children to be able to sew and provide things for their children. And then the young girls that we have to let me work with them where they can start their own small business and see that whether you're hemming jeans for your friends at school or whether you're putting patches on, you know, you can start right now building that base. And when your peer group sees you and what you have on, then they can come to you. Well, where'd you get that? Well, I did it. And that's the way of you starting your own business, you know, right now, just to give them some of the benefits of some of the things that I've been given.
Wow. So do you ever find yourself encouraging other people to join the military?
Yes, I do. Yes, I do. And I had encouraged my daughter until she hurt her foot. But I think nowadays and times it would be a good thing. Her dad did not want her to. I said, you know, I'm of this like mine. I said, if God could take care of her in Louisville, Kentucky, surely he can take care of her wherever it is she goes. I said, so we have to exercise some faith here. And so, yeah, I do. I do encourage ladies to definitely go to the military.
Do you, I guess finally I'd like to ask you, do you have any advice for people, especially women who are interested in joining the military?
Yes, just to be sure that you're willing to do whatever it takes to be the best that you can be. Nothing that will hurt anyone. If you feel like you're a person that can take instruction, you're a team player, you work well on your own, and you just want to have somebody make you get down inside yourself and bring out the best of you, that's the place to do it. School is not going to do it. That's a whole different agenda, you know, but the military, I mean, they deal with you on such personal levels about who you are and what you are inside. And they put you through the test sometime without you even knowing that you're being put through that test. And at the end of the day, you're like, I did that. I actually climbed over that 10-foot wall with a rifle on my back, jumped down in a foxhole and emptied a magazine and drove a 5-ton truck. I mean, it's amazing. I never thought I would do any of those things. Never in a million years. But I did. They showed me things about myself that I didn't know. And an experience like that would definitely do that for you.
Thanks for the advice. Is there anything else you'd like to add before we can
go? No, I'm good. Okay. I'm good.
I'd like to thank you on behalf of the United States Library of Congress for sharing your story.
Well, thank you for wanting me to share. I really am. I was telling my husband about it. I said, I'm just honored to be even asked to do that. I said, so even when I'm gone from this earth, there's going to be somebody that's going to research women in the military, and maybe they'll hear my story, and maybe that'll be encouraging for them.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Thank you,
Deanna. This is the first time for you too, but you've been a jewel. You've been a jewel.
Thank you. You made it easy. So I'm gonna stop the tape.